666.
Is the person who's giving class usually try Rodham, or do they just get right into it?
Just go right into it.
Okay.
We do the other
bhajans. Mm-hmm. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Kim te kama sura sparha. Mukunda manaso dvija. Adi jadur mudam ragya. Shuditasya yate tade. Kinte kama sura sparha. Mukunda manaso dvija. Adi jadur mudam ragya. Suditasya yate tade. Kim te kama sura sparha. Mukunda manaso dvija. Adi jadur mudam ragya. Suditasya yate tade. Others? Kinte kama sura sparha. Anybody else like to chant the verse?
Shuditasya yate tare.
Kim. Kim. What for? Tay. All those. Comma. Objects of sensed enjoyment. Sorta. Of the denizens of heaven. Sparha. Aspirations. Mukunda Manasa. Of one who is already God conscious. Dvija. O Brahmanas. Adijaru. Could satisfy. Mudam. Pleasure. Ragya. Of the king. Shudatasya. Of the hungry. Yataha. As it is. Itare. In other things. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. O Brahmanas, the opulence of the king was so enchanting that the denizens of heaven aspired for it. But because he was absorbed in the service of the Lord, nothing can satisfy him except the Lord's service. Purport. There are two things in the world which can satisfy living beings. When one is materially engrossed, he is satisfied only by sense gratification. But when one is liberated from the conditions of the material modes, he is satisfied only by rendering loving service for the satisfaction of the Lord. This means that the living being is constitutionally a servitor, not one who is served. Being illusioned by the conditions of the external energy, one falsely thinks himself to be the served, but actually he is not served. He is the servant of the senses, like lust, desire, anger, avarice, pride, madness, and intolerance. When one is in his proper senses by attainment of spiritual knowledge, he realizes that he is not the master of the material world, but is only a servant of the senses. At that time, he begs for the service of the Lord and thus becomes happy without being illusioned by so-called material happiness. It's actually a very famous verse that Prabhupada was fond of quoting, which I think he's referring to here. And so I'll quote it. Unfortunately, I don't have it by memory, so I'll just have to read it. But Prabhupada quoted this various occasions in his classes. It says, Kamadinam katita katita palita durnideshas. Tesham jata mai. It's on page 401 in the shloka book, if anybody wants to look on. Tesham jata mai na karuna na chrapa no pasanti. Utsrijaitan ata yadupate sampraptam lava buddhis. Twam ayata sharanam abayam mam niyunksh vatma dasye. And that's from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 325-35. And the translation is, O my Lord, there is no limit to the unwanted orders of lusty desires. Although I have rendered them so much service, they have not shown any mercy to me. I have not been ashamed to serve them, nor have I even desired to give them up. O my Lord, O head of the Yadu dynasty, recently, however, my intelligence has been awakened, and now I am giving them up. Due to transcendental intelligence, I now refuse to obey the unwanted orders of these desires, and I now come to you to surrender myself at your fearless lotus feet. Kindly engage me in your personal service and save me. On several occasions, actually, Prabhupada gave this as like a working definition of the Hare Krishna mantra. You know, he referred to it like that. That's a very nice verse. It's found in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Does anybody know who's the original author of that verse? It's Rupa Goswami, huh? Because sometimes Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu was concluding, you know, things from other Vaishnavas. But anyway, okay. Okay, so reading on, it says, Yamaraj Yudhisthira was one of the liberated souls, and therefore for him there was no pleasure in a vast kingdom, good wife, obedient brothers, happy subjects, and prosperous world. These blessings automatically follow for a pure devotee, even though the devotee does not aspire for them. The example set herein is exactly suitable. It is said that one who is hungry is never satisfied by anything other than food. The whole material world is full of hungry living beings. The hunger is not for good food, shelter, or sense gratification. The hunger is for spiritual atmosphere. Due to ignorance only, they think that the world is dissatisfied because there is not sufficient food, shelter, defense, and objects of sense gratification. This is called illusion. But when the living being is hungry for spiritual satisfaction, he is misrepresented by material hunger. But the foolish leaders cannot see that even the people who are most sumptuously materially satisfied are still hungry. And what is their hunger and poverty? This hunger is actually for spiritual food, spiritual shelter, spiritual defense, and spiritual sense gratification. These can be obtained in the association of the Supreme Spirit, Lord Sri Krishna, and therefore one who has them cannot be attracted by the so-called food, shelter, defense, and sense gratification of the material world, even if they are relished by the denizens of the heavenly planets. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita 8.16, it is said by the Lord that even in the topmost planet of the universe, namely Brahmaloka, where the duration of life is multiplied by millions of years by earth calculation, one cannot satisfy his hunger. Such hunger can be satisfied only when the living being is situated in immortality, which is attained in the spiritual sky far, far above Brahmaloka, in the association of Lord Mukunda, the Lord who awards his devotees the transcendental pleasure of liberation. Maham Vishnu Badaya Krishna Vastan Budlay Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamanita Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivashesha Sanyavadi Pastachari Shatarani Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhuna Chananda Shed Vaita Gadadar Shivasati Gauravani Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So Prabhupada, in the beginning of this purport, is making this point how we're constitutionally servitors. And if we're not engaged, if we're not willing to be engaged in the transcendent loving service of the Lord, then we have no choice. We're going to be forced to serve the dictates, kam, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, and matsarya, lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, and envy. And there's no other alternative. It's like, just to give an example, it's like those of you who have been to Mayapur, and you know that we go swimming in the Ganges. It's like if you jump in the Ganges, you got to do one of two things. You either got to be prepared to start swimming upstream, you know, right away, as hard as you can, or you got to be prepared to just be pushed downstream. There's no question of jumping in the Ganges, at least, you know, during the times of year that I've been there, and you're going to be able to just tread water and stay in the same place. It doesn't work like that. You know, there's a current. So you either got to jump in there and swim upstream, at least, and even then you'll be lucky if you get very far. You'll probably be lucky just to hold your position even doing that, or you're just going to be swept downstream. So it's kind of like that. We're servants, so if somebody, and we have that free will, and if we don't have that desire, willingness to want to try to engage in devotional service, then, you know, the other alternative is just forced upon us. We have to serve Maya. There's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Nahi kaschit shanamapi jatu tishtatiya karma krit karyatehi avasha karma sarva prakriti jagana, that all men are forced to act helplessly according to the impulses born of the three modes of material nature. See? No one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. And Prabhupada explains that the soul is always active. So if you're not active in serving Krishna, if you're not active in the good works of Krishna consciousness, then you will be dictated to, you'll be engaged in occupations dictated by the illusory energy. So that's the way it works, you know. Jatu tishni, sarva prakriti jagana, or impulses born of the three modes of material nature. So it's only when you surrender to Krishna that you transcend those impulses born of the three modes of material nature, you know. And you come under the protection of the internal potency of the Lord. There's that nice verse in the ninth chapter, Mahatmanas Tumam Parta Daivim Prakritim Ashrita Pajanti Ananya Manasogya Fabhutadi Mahavitam. Daivim Prakritim Ashrita. After you surrender to Krishna, you come under the protection of the Daivi Prakriti, and then you're engaged in devotional service. But if you don't do that, then it's prakate kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha ahankara vamudhama kartahamiti manyate, that you'll be engaged, the bewildered soul, under the influence of the three modes of material nature. He thinks himself the doer of activities, which are actually, you know, just, he's just acting according to the dictates of the material energy. So that's how it works. And Prabhupada's pointing out here that, you know, people, even they have sufficient food, shelter, material food, shelter, defense, objects of sense gratification, they're not satisfied because actually their hunger is a spiritual, they have hunger for the spiritual atmosphere. And Prabhupada gives that nice example of the bird in the cage. You know, if you clean the cage, but you forget to feed the bird, then the bird dies, even though you have a nice clean cage. So it's like that. We see, you know, people really are hankering for something spiritual. And we experience that when we go out on Sankirtan, really. When you, out of 100 people that we approach, and, you know, with the books, and we, I mean, at least some of the devotees, distributors I know, we're always telling them a little something about the philosophy, showing them a picture about karma, showing them the picture of the, you know, how the soul continues from one body to the other and onto the next body. People are kind of, you know, out of 100 people, I'd say like 10 or 20 kind of are interested. And a lot of them are just kind of like, you know, they're quiet. They don't say much one way or the other. And maybe only 1 in 100 people will just say something like, ah, I don't believe that, you know. Very rarely does somebody just kind of, nah, just forget, you know. There, that does happen. But for the most part, people are kind of like, okay, oh, that's interesting. You know, or they might even respond very positively like, whoa, that's, yeah, I'm into the, yeah. And they already know what you're talking about. They're right with you. So, you know, there's like a spiritual inclination there. And that's what's supposed to be happening in the human form of life. Unfortunately, due to, you know, so much bad leadership, people are being cheated of their, or deprived of their opportunity to, you know, properly utilize the human form of life. There's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, yad yada charti shresas tattadevetarojana sayat pramanam kurute lokas taranavartate, that whatever a great person does, the common men follow in his footsteps, and whatever standard he sets by exemplary acts, the whole world pursues. So, of course, you know, just broad or paraphrasing that, or whatever the person who's the leader does, I mean, they might be a great person or not, whatever the, you know, the most powerful people are doing, that's, everybody follows in their footsteps. You know, we see that, the examples of that are so obvious in terms of, you know, like sometimes you, on Sankirtan, you notice all of a sudden everybody's saying the same thing. You know, they have this phrase, you know, and they're all, wherever you go, any place in the country, people just have this, like, you know, they're expressing, they're just sort of saying the same thing. They get it from television, they get it from a movie. You know, it's just something they see some person who's some sort of a star do in a movie or something like that, and they just start imitating it. And before you know it, it's all over the country. They're all, and then it disappears. You know, it disappears after a few months, and then you wait some time, and then there's another one after another 6 months or something like that. So people just, you know, follow and on. But unfortunately, they don't have good leadership. Prabhupada said in one lecture he gave in 1966 in New York, it was transcribed and turned into that book, Raja Vidya, King of Knowledge. He said that this material world is being managed by rakshasas, man-eating demons who will crush their own sons for the satisfaction of their senses. So, you know, that's nothing. But it's nothing new. It's nothing new. That's what's, you know, supposed to happen in Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga means it's the age where, by, you know, the Maya's arrangement, people are given opportunity to try to be happy by engaging in unrestricted sense gratification, you know, if they want to. They're also given the chance to, a very good chance, and especially in this particular Kali Yuga, a very good chance to properly utilize their human form of life and go back to Godhead, because Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement is present on the planet for the last 500 years and will be so for the next 9,500 years. So it's a very interesting age that we're living in, because it's, you know, on the people have an incredible opportunity to, you know, elevate themselves and go back to Godhead. And the demigods, and there's one verse in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam where it talks about how the demigods are actually lining up, you know, somebody, so to speak, are lining up to take birth in this Kali Yuga, because they're envious, or they're, you know, they know, wow, one short birth as a human being in the Kali Yuga on the planet Earth, and you can go back to Godhead. It's not that simple for them, apparently. So, you know, on the one hand, it's an incredible opportunity to take the spiritual life and go back to Godhead. And on the other hand, people who neglect this opportunity, you know, just kind of don't take up Krishna consciousness or don't have any interest in it, regard for it at all whatsoever. It's like they've purchased a one-way ticket to hell because, the atmosphere is so surcharged with sinful activities. Without Krishna consciousness, what are they doing? You know, just one sinful activity after another. And, they're clocking up a big a big account of sinful activities, and at the time of death, they're gonna be held accountable for that, and it's not going to be, a nice situation. There's nothing to be shocked about, though. That's the way it works. You know, this is Kali Yuga. It's the age for that. But anyway, people do have that spiritual inclination. And, given the opportunity, a lot of people will at least do something. You know, that's where we come into the picture, actually. You know, and that's, it's an opportunity for us to get purified. There's one occasion in Los Angeles. Prabhupada was speaking in his room there, and some of his sannyasi disciples were there. So after he finished speaking, it was Vishnu John Maharaj. He actually raised his hand and he said, "Prabhupada," very earnestly, and he spoke very sincerely. He says, "Prabhupada," maybe you've seen the video, you know. "Bhaktivinoda Thakur said he's leaving his work undone." You know, that was the gist of it, you know. You know, very like dramatically he presents it. And Prabhupada said, "Yeah." He said he's Vaishnav. He could deliver the entire universe. But he's leaving some service for you to do. You know. He left his work undone, so now, you know, let us do the work of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and do something. Now, here's your opportunity. So that's the way we can look at it. Krishna doesn't need us to, you know, deliver the fallen conditioned souls, really. I mean, it's explained in the Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter. Krishna says, "Tesham eva anukampartam aham agyana jam tamaha nashyami atma bhavishto gyana dipena bhashvata." He says, "Out of compassion for them, I who am dwelling within their heart destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance." So that's the only way anybody gets enlightened anyway, right? Ultimately, it's just Krishna. Krishna has to enlighten you from within. So he doesn't need our help to do that. He can do that at any second. I mean, in the next second like that, this entire world could be completely, fully, 100% enlightened in Krishna consciousness if that was Krishna's desire. Because he's totally in control. That's in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, Krishna's referred to as Dhyanpati, the Lord of Intelligence. And it's, of course, that verse in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where he says, "Savasya chaham ridisane vishtoma taksmitu gyanam apohanam cha." "I'm seated in everyone's heart. From me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness." So, you know, it's something that Krishna's totally in control of. It's like some places, I don't think you have it here, we have light switches here, but they have the dimmer. And, you know, the dimmer allows you to have gradations of light. So, you know, you can sort of make it very bright, or you can just gradually turn it down to get dimmer. So it's kind of, I think it's something more like that in terms of the living entity, you know, that Krishna's got his hands on the they call it a dimmer, and it could be a brightener for that matter too. And depending upon how the living entity's attitude, you know, towards him and towards the spiritual life, Krishna, just from within the heart, he's just either turning it one way or the other. If you want to try to live, enjoy life in rebellion or in defiance to the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then he just turns it one way and it gets dimmer. You know, you just become more in illusion, more absorbed into the modes of material nature and less, you know, have less spiritual insight. And when you're, you know, going the other way, you're leaning the other way, and you're desiring to know, well, what is this? What's going on here? You know, why am I suffering? Why am I here? Is there a God? You know, what's my... Then Krishna turns it the other way, and he, you know, just tries to help you progress in the direction of the light. So anyway, getting back to the point, Krishna doesn't need us, but it's an opportunity for us to do service. We have a wonderful opportunity to engage in devotional service. you know, here and now, especially now in the Kali Yuga, because there's so many fallen souls. Lord Chaitanya's mission is to deliver the most fallen first, right? There's so many fallen souls. The things are so, you know, materialistic and degraded. We have a wonderful opportunity to engage in Sankirtan and get purified ourselves and really render the best possible service that can be rendered to the people who aren't devotees. Because, as we mentioned, somebody is in Kali Yuga, living in Kali Yuga, it might appear, superficially it appears that, what are you talking about? They're doing okay. Look, you know, they have nice homes and nice cars. And okay, but from the Vedic perspective, they're in big trouble. You know, from the Vedic perspective, they're in big trouble. They're just engaging in so many sinful activities. And, you know, at the time of death, all of a sudden, they're going to be awaiting a rude awakening, cruising for a bruising, so to speak. You know, it's like, it ain't going to be like what they think. You know, at least according to the, you know, what we learned from the Bhagavatam. So even if they can't become devotees, if they can't become full-on devotees in this lifetime, just the fact that if they meet a devotee, get a book, and give a donation, I'm pretty sure they're, you know, Prabhupada has said, the statements are there that just that is enough to get them a human body in their next lifetime. Right? And Prabhupada would, you know, there's that verse, Neha Bhikkhamanasto Sti Pachavayo Nivijate Swalpam Api Asya Dharmasha Swalpam Api Asya Dharmasha Trayate Mahatobayan. That in this endeavor, there's no loss or diminution and a little bit of advancement. Just that, just taking the book and giving a donation can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. And Prabhupada, at least on several occasions, described that as being losing the human form of life. Once after going through all, you know, it takes millions of years once you're down there to come back to the human form of life and to just lose it like that and go back down again. That's the greatest danger. So we have the opportunity to, you know, be instrumental in saving them from that, giving them a chance to at least engage in some, if not pure devotional service, a Gyata Sukriti. And just on the strength of that, they'll get another chance. They'll come back. They'll get another human body. And then in that next lifetime, they'll get another opportunity to once again engage in devotional service. They get, you know, another opportunity, another chance. So that's very wonderful. And so we should be very enthusiastic, as you know, as this yatra already is, to go out and try to give people the mercy. They want it. You know, this Prabhupada, on one occasion, he said, there's Brahmins on every corner. There's Brahmins on every street corner. They're just waiting for us to go out there and contact them and meet them. And we're meeting so many favorable people. You know, practically every school we go to, there's so many students there, you know. So eager, enthusiastic to engage, you know, want the books and give donations, engage in devotional service. So Prabhupada's also, it's pointing out here, it's talking about how only this, only the, you know, the spiritual atmosphere, that's the only thing that'll really satisfy people. And even, you know, somebody could be in a ideal situation materially, and there's so many examples of this, of people being in what would seem to be idealistic material situations, and they're completely unhappy to the point where they commit suicide. One famous example of that is Marilyn Monroe. Famous example, maybe all of you have heard her name. Very famous actress. You know, she was like, had a famous as being an extremely beautiful woman, talented woman, actress. You know, all sorts of like famous men were interested in her. You know, she was married to Joe DiMaggio at one time, famous, you know, Yankee baseball player. Anyway, so, but she was miserable somehow, and she actually committed suicide. I mean, it's just like blew everybody's mind when they even, how could somebody that was so famous, so popular, so, you know, everything, wealthy and the whole works, you know, and physical, good physical health, but the mind, you know, it's just because it doesn't really satisfy. You know, the material opulence doesn't really satisfy. Actually, sometimes what to speak of satisfy can have the opposite effect. There's that verse in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where it says, Avritam gyanam etena gyaneno nichavayrana kamanupena kunteya duspareena nalenacha. That sometimes, you know, it's described that sometimes it's like lust is like a fire
the more fuel you supply to it, then the more powerful it becomes. You know, the way to put out the fire is not to give it fuel. Sometimes it looks like it is, you can have that illusion can be there. I don't know if you've experienced this, but like you could have a little fire, and if you pour a lot of gasoline on it, at first it appears to like it's going out. It looks like it looks like it's going out, but it doesn't work like that. You know, it's just actually, I don't know what it's doing there, but it takes a few seconds, and all of a sudden it goes whoom. You know, I've seen that personally. You know, you just. Remember, if you're doing a campfire or something like that, you squirt in the kerosene and it looks like it's gone down, but then it just takes a few seconds and it just burns it up or something, and wham. So it's lust is like that. It's never satisfied and it burns like fire. And the more people have facility, you know, it's sometimes the worse off they are. There's an expression in English, if you give a fool enough rope, he'll hang himself. So that's what happens, you know. If you give a fool enough rope, he'll hang himself. And there's a verse like that in the Bhagavatam. It's talking about how, you know, the big turban. And that big turban, unless you bow it down at the lotus feet of Krishna, then it's just going to, you know, you're just going to cause you to go down yourself. So it's like that. These people, they're unfortunately, they have a lot of rope, and they're hanging themselves, a lot of them. Rather than engaging in devotional service, they're just hanging themselves. They're just getting themselves so entangled and so absorbed in material life that it's very difficult. It's going to be very difficult for them to take the Krishna consciousness, at least in this lifetime. Whereas we see a lot of the people who are very simple, they have practically nothing, and you know they're more able easily receive Krishna consciousness. So yeah, unfortunately, the material doesn't satisfy. I had a really an interesting experience along these lines when I was a younger devotee, and I was in the New York temple. At that time, the temple was in Manhattan. You know, we had the temple in Brooklyn, and they bought that 11-story building in Midtown Manhattan, 1975. So I was part of that crew that went over to that. And it was the winter, and in New York, you get a winter. You know, it's not like here. You actually get, it gets cold, it gets rainy, it snows and like that. But sorry, we were doing the Prabhupada marathon, and you know, it was like a bit of a military atmosphere back in those days. Akura Nath, I'm sure, remembers. You know, it was not messing around. It was serious stuff. You know, when it was time to go out on Sankirtan, if you were on a party, you know, you had to be there, and you know, because devotees were serious about getting out there, working hard, getting a result. Anyway, on this particular morning, I think it was during the month of December. I'm pretty sure. I got up late, so I was tired. You know, I went through the morning program. I was tired, so I thought it was breakfast time came around, and I thought, okay, if I don't take a nap now, I'm not going to have an opportunity during the day because it's winter. You know, I wasn't the van leader. I was just one of the members on the party. I just got dropped off in a parking lot, and that was it. Then I just had to fend for myself for the rest of the day. You know, I couldn't just, you know, go into the department store and lie down someplace, or you know, there's no facility. Once I tried something like that, once I was out on a parking lot and I was so tired, I went and I lied down, and I just found the car that I saw the button was up, and I opened the door and I lied down in the back seat of some guy's car. And I got a good nap, but he came. And then he just was like shocked. So I just told him the truth. I apologized. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm out here, you know, doing this thing, and I got really tired. I hope you don't mind too much, you know. he was so shocked. He just sort of, when does anybody ever do that, you know? And on the ordinary circumstances, I would never do that, but, you know. Anyway, devotees did some amazing things on Sankirtan. But getting back to the story, so you know, so that particular morning, I thought I'd try to squeeze in a nap before going out on Sankirtan. So I tried, but it didn't work. And then by the time I got down there to the, you know, the prasadam hall, which is in the basement there, there was no prasadam. But it was time to go, you know. So tired and without the prasadam, I had to just hop, you know, get my stuff and hop in the van. And so I ran upstairs, you know, to get my stuff. And when I got down there, my party had pulled out already. They'd gone. So there I was, you know, tired, hungry, and no party to go out with. So the Sankirtan leader told me, said, well, you're just going to have to go downtown. And, you know, downtown wasn't considered like the best spots. You know, we usually would travel outside the city to shopping centers in New Jersey or in Westchester County or something like that, you know. But I had no alternative. So I just hopped on the train and I went down. I was down around like 8th Avenue and 34th Street or something like that, just some, you know, street. And so I figured, okay, well, I guess I should try to get start. So I was, you know, trying to start my Sankirtan, but it was really cold. You know, and I said I was hungry, tired, and it was cold, and it started to rain. Not heavy, just kind of like more than yesterday, though. It was more than just like, it wasn't a full-on heavy rain, but it was something a little bit more than a drizzle. It was, you know, and I was, you know, standing, I was totally, and I was thinking, wow, I don't think I could be more miserable than this. Here I am, you know, I'm standing here, and I was like, my mind was freaking out, you know. Can you imagine? I was hungry, I was cold, I was tired. And now it was like the rain was coming down. I didn't have an umbrella. I was standing out there. And it was the marathon. I was expected to do big. I had that pressure, you know, like you got to do good. So, wow, I didn't, you know, I was, what to do. And so fortunately, I, by Krishna's mercy, I did something that worked. It was good. Back about a year or two before that, when the temple was still in Brooklyn, I used to go on Sankirtan to Port Authority bus station. And there was a period there while all the devotees went to India, and I was kind of, you know, for a while I was going out on my own, just, you know, just I was distributing and coming back. And one day when I came back, Harikesh, he was a brahmachari at that time, he noticed I didn't look so enthusiastic. So he said, what's up? I said, well, you know, I don't feel absorbed. He said, I said, I'm doing my service. I'm going out every day. I'm doing sound, but I don't feel absorbed. He said, that's because your mind is not absorbed. You know, it's being absorbed. You know, you're not, you know, I don't feel enthusiastic. He said, because your mind is not absorbed in Krishna. And I said, oh, he's standing now. I remember. He said, now. I said, what do you mean? I'm going out. I'm doing my service. I'm doing everything. He said, but no, you're not absorbed in Krishna. I said, well, how do you get absorbed? He said, well, you know, you have to like, do you know any shlokas? I didn't know any shlokas at that point. He said, well, you have to, you know, memorize some shlokas. I said, well, okay, what do I do? So he gave me a list of 13 shlokas. He said that Prabhupada had given him. And he said, learn these. He said, if you learn these 13 shlokas, Prabhupada said that you could, you know, defeat most of the Mayavadis or something like that. Or you could preach, you know, just on the strength of these 13 shlokas. He said, learn those. And when you learn them, when you memorize them, Sanskrit and English, come back and I'll teach you, I'll show you how to use them in preaching, and then I'll give you some more. So I did that. I did it. I was surprised myself. I learned them very quickly. And I went back, and he was pleased, you know. And then he gave me 26 more. And then this is just during this period, like about 3 weeks when the devotees were away, 3 or 4 weeks the devotees went to India. He was in charge at that time. The temple president had gone. So I came back, and he gave me 26 more. And I learned those. And I was surprised myself because I hadn't been into learning shlokas, and I was amazed that I was, by Krishna's mercy, I was learning them. And then came back and recited all those for him. And he said, okay, well, learn the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So I learned the ninth chapter. And then I came back, and then he said, okay, well, learn the seventh chapter. And then the devotees had come back, but I went ahead and did it. So I had, you know, I learned some shlokas there. And then I went ahead and learned a couple other chapters on my own, you know, just, you know, separate after from that experience there. So, and from time to time I would revise. I wasn't somebody who was giving class at that point, but I would just, you know, chant them for myself, my own purification, and revise them periodically. So on this particular occasion there, I was desperate. I was desperate, you know. I was standing there, as I mentioned, I was cold. I was tired, hungry, cold, and now getting wet. And the day was wearing on. The pressure was mounting. You know, I was feeling like I got to do something. You know. And I guess, I don't know, I could have just, of course, chanted Hare Krishna. That's absolute, that's always, but on this, for some reason, on this particular occasion, I thought, okay, I'm just going to start chanting these shlokas. So I started off with the second chapter, you know, Tam Stata Kripaya Vishnam Ashru Purno Glekshanam Vishidam Tamadam Bacham Vachamara Sutana. And I just started going through the verses, you know, one after another. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Kutastam Glamidam Vishami Samapashtam Anarya Ushumashvatam Kirtam Kram. And, you know, not really expecting anything, but just I thought, well, okay, you know, I might as well do something with my mind, try to get absorbed somehow, you know. But immediately it was like helpful. And, you know, immediately I just started feeling like calmer, more calm and peaceful. And I realized, okay, it's not the end of the world. It's not so, you know, it's not so bad. It's only one day on Sankirtan, even if it, you know, doesn't work out so great, so what? And I kept chanting. And within about like 5 or 10 minutes, I went from, you know, being in total anxiety and feeling completely miserable to feeling completely blissful. I just kept chanting those shlokas. And then by Krishna's mercy, I started getting a taste as I was chanting it. I guess, I don't know, Krishna just felt merciful that day to me, you know. And I was chanting, it was nectar. I was chanting the shlokas and I was just relishing relishing the nectar of chanting those shlokas. There's that verse in the Bhagavatam, Vayam tuna vachipyama yat uchama shloka vikame yat shrinvatam rasagyanam svadu svadu pade pade. I think Suta Goswami, is he speaking to the sages of Naimisharanya? The sages are speaking to him, right? And they're telling him, you know, we don't tire of hearing you. Matter, just quite the contrary. It's getting more relishable. Every moment, it's just hearing you. It's swadu, swadu, pade, pade. It just gets more relishable by the moment, just hearing what you're saying. So it was like that. It was just getting more and more relishable. You know, the taste was there. And so that was nice. And then, you know, I did that. I chanted all my shlokas. And by the end of the whole thing, I kind of felt like composed again, you know. And I, okay, focused my intelligence, got into it, and I wound up was able to do some Sankirtan as well. But it gave me an incredible realization that that was a real gift from Krishna. It was a real present from Krishna, that experience, because it gave me a very clear, decisive realization how Krishna consciousness is transcendental. It's transcendental. And that the happiness from Krishna consciousness is something just not material, nothing to do with material, because there I was. I'm going to, you know, analyze it. There I was, tired, hungry, cold, getting wet, in complete anxiety about, you know, success or failure type of thing, okay? You know, perfect like remedy for being miserable and having a nervous breakdown or something like that. But what happened? I took shelter of those shlokas, of the process of hearing and chanting, and by that choice, by that decision and, you know, activity, then Krishna reciprocated and I got that, you know, got that mercy. And I realized, wow, Krishna consciousness is totally transcendental. It's totally transcendental. The happiness of Krishna consciousness has nothing to do with happiness in the material world. So it was very nice. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes Krishna has to, despite the fact that I've had that experience was there and I've had other experiences like that, it's so easy to kind of slip back into complacency and you know, lose that intensity. See, apparently, I'm not an authority on this subject. So maybe when I'll stop speaking in a minute or two, we could talk about it a bit. But it seems like Krishna really wants to see a certain degree of intensity, you know. He's not particularly attracted by lackadaisical devotional service, you know, like Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. You know, that doesn't really attract Krishna, you know, to. But when you're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, you know, that's the kind of the chanting that Krishna seems to respond to more. And I'm sure there's like Shastric statements to that effect that support that point. So sometimes it's hard to get that intensity. But, and the third canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada explains that there's these two potencies of Maya. There's the Prapshapatmika and the Avanaratmika potencies of Maya. Prapshapatmika? I was at a tough time pronouncing that one. I believe is the throwing potency. So Maya actually has a potency by which she kind of bewilders your mind into, you know, thinking, you know, just not understanding the philosophy properly, and you know, just she distracts you from your intelligence, from knowing, you know, from that understanding of what you have to do to get Krishna's mercy. Somehow or another, she manages to do that. And then when she's got you off the track, then Avinaratmika, covering. That's the covering potency. So those two things are there. So I guess that's my understanding of what's the explanation for why it is, despite the fact that somebody, me or anybody, could actually have that experience. You know, you have a very solid experience of the taste for chanting, And then the very next day, you could not be, you know, you could come back and not be serious, not be willing to be, you know, come up with the intensity necessary to reproduce it, to get it again. You know, it's amazing. But and then that's one interesting point on that. It's that gives us insight into why Prabhupada gave us, and why in this process you have regulative principles. You know, if it was left up to our mind, you know, if it's left up to us, just, you know, if the instruction was just chant Hare Krishna, you know, one day we might chant 92 rounds or something, next day one round, and it's be, but it's we see, apparently, at least myself, I could see the, I can appreciate the necessity for, you know, a regulation that you have to do it this much. You have to, you know, you have to do this many, this much deity worship, this much chanting, this much, because, you know, if it was just left up to our the whims of our mind, we'd be all over the place. So at least this way, we're kind of kept, yeah.
Also, devotee association. Like you were saying, when you're really down like this,
yeah.
And Maya has its throwing potency and covering potency, just association with devotees can bring a person back from, you know, this faltering type of a thing. Because when they are by themselves, more and more than Maya's influence is there. But then they come back in this environment and they hear and listen, they can get back to this, the mood that you are talking about,
yeah,
which is needed.
Yeah, very much so. Like the devotee association is very important because, well, you know, like Prabhupada was, if it wasn't for the Prabhupada, I don't know that we could have really continued as devotees, because Prabhupada was a living example of this philosophy. You know, Prabhupada was a living example of that Krishna consciousness is transcendental. And, you know, so that enthused the devotees. Just like when you, you know, when you're in Maya, it's a ten, and you forget that there is, you're not willing to come up, you know, bring to the table what's required to get that higher taste. And after a while, you start even doubting that there is such a thing as, you forget the fact that you've ever had a higher taste, and you start doubting that there is such a thing as a higher taste. It's amazing. Even somebody who's really, like, you know, at some point in their career had a really been really doing good in Krishna consciousness, can just someone just down the track a little bit be so bewildered by Maya that you could be even doubting that there is such a thing as a higher taste, and having forgotten all about all the good experiences you had. So that's why it's really important to be in an association of people who are, you know, because they force it. It's a little uncomfortable sometimes, actually, if, you know, if you, when you're in that much Maya, you want to, don't, because you don't want to be confronted by that, because you don't want to, that means you have to do something about it. But, you know, it's important to be, yeah.
When I was in law school, I had a friend who was in the anthropology PhD program at University of Michigan. He was a sociobiologist, you know, studying all human behavior and morality. He was trying, you know, his theory was, or the theory of the people he was following, is all explainable by, you know, the sort of impulse of genes to maximize the inclusive fitness of their own gene pool. In other words, mechanical material explanation of everything. Richard Dawkins, the atheist, was his hero. And
okay.
We used to sit and argue all night. And he was one time, and we had both been philosophy students at the University of Maryland together before we went to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he was, one time he was telling me, he was taking the position of a positivist who only believes in things that they see. And he says, if there's a God, then why, you know, I'll believe in God when he comes and he tweaks me on the cheek. Then I'll believe that there's a God. And I told him, even if he comes and tweaks you on the cheek, the next minute you'll just forget it.
Yeah.
So that's the potency of Maya is so strong that you have some intense experience, but it's able to be covered over. Although Narada Muni says they never really become. Once someone becomes a rasagraha, then they can never become an ordinary karmi. They still have. They'll still remember that fragrance of Krishna's lotus feet again.
Prabhuji, you mentioned that after 10,000 years of golden age, 500 years have passed, and 9,500 years are left. And what if we are not successful in this present life, in achieving the ultimate goal of life, and then we die, and then we have to take a subsequent birth? What if we don't, if the subsequent birth doesn't come within the next 9,500 years? Can that happen?
Sure, it will, though. I mean, it will. I mean, I'm not the person who arranges it all, but that's my understanding. I mean, you know, you'll take birth again, and you'll take birth, you know, hopefully in a family of devotees, and you'll get an opportunity to take up from where you left off in this lifetime.
But it also says that, you know, that person first of all goes to heavenly planets or somewhere, and then after enjoying there for many, many years, then he comes back. So
yeah, I understand what you're saying. You might miss out. By the time you finish with the heavenly planets, you'll come back down here and Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement will be all finished, right? Yeah, don't worry about it. Krishna's in control. You know, Krishna's in control. We just read about how he's Pranata Karuna. You know, he's the best well-wisher of the surrendered souls. So Krishna's overseeing the whole thing. And, you know, you're not going to get the short end of the stick. Quite the contrary. You're going to get probably something better than what you deserve. If we just sincerely engage in devotional service as best we can in this lifetime, and if somehow or another we're not able to, you know, come up to the perfectional standard, then Krishna's going to make some nice arrangement for us. He's going to give us a nice opportunity our next lifetime to, you know, to continue our devotional service. And, you know, Kunteya pratijanahi name bhakta pranashati. You know, it's like Krishna says to Arjuna in the ninth chapter, he says, declare it boldly, my devotee never perishes. In other words, you know, and there's another verse in the sixth chapter, he says, one who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. Krishna's in control. We don't have to worry. If we're sincerely, you know, engage in devotional service, Krishna's taking care of us. That's kind of satisfy your... Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. That you are mentioning in the class, like 13 slokas are about Mayavadis. So where can we find Prabhu? Because fortunate enough, I'm meeting a lot of Mayavadis nowadays.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember what they are, but somebody was just, we were reading something the other day, a letter. Didn't you have a letter from Bhaktivikash Maharaj?
Yeah. That there are 30 verses in the Bhagavad Gita where if you learn those, you can... You can defeat all Mayavadis just based on the 30 Gita verses.
Yeah, I think he was quoting a letter that Prabhupada wrote to Satsrupa Maharaj or something, an interaction between Prabhupada and Satsrupa Maharaj. So apparently there is some list from Prabhupada of 30 shlokas, which if you know... That's sufficient for you to deal with any of these, you know.
Yeah, one sloka, it is in Ishopanishad, I think it's mantra 15, Prabhu. Hiranya. I mean, so that sloka, it talks about God's form.
In Bhagavad Gita, there's Avajananti Mamuda, Manusim Tanam Ashrutam, and another one Prabhupada would quote, what's that one? Yeah. Right, that was it. Yeah. Yeah, right there in the Bhagavad Gita, there's sufficient ammunition to deal with these Mayavadi impersonalists.
Even though if we mentioned about slokas to them, they won't believe. I don't know how to convince. If show the sloka to them, means we need to tell it.
Well, you know, that's Kali Yuga. I mean, I think Prabhupada, or at least devotees in classes, have explained that people aren't gentlemen in Kali Yuga. You know, formerly that if you engage in like a philosophical debate with somebody and you were defeated, you became their disciple. Or if you defeated them, they became your disciple. But if you, I don't know if you've probably observed this, you know, now when you meet people on Sankirtan, even you defeat them, even like you just defeat them, and then they kind of wiggle out of that, and you defeat that argument. They're always squirming from one argument to the next, and they never just acknowledge, okay, you've defeated my arguments. They just change the subject, or they're not gentlemen.
So my atheist friend from University of Michigan. I lost touch with him for over 20 years, and I got in touch with him about a year ago on the internet. He's now a professor of anthropology in Utah at a major university there. Uh-huh. And he did his specialty was polyandry, when you know, a woman marries many, many brothers, you know, sort of like Draupadi married the five Pandavas. You know? So he went to certain places like in Nepal and things like that, or Tibet, where this practice was going on. So he told me that he has become a Hindu now.
Wow.
So you never know. You might talk to these people and argue with them and then leave them alone, and that you've planted a seed that may grow. Yeah.
Thank you, Prabhupada. Thank you very much.
One more. When Prabhupada talked about that, there is a, I think, palm tree or tal tree. And from the tal tree, a fruit fell down. And then the crow was there, sitting there. So there are two Brahmins. So first Brahmin said, I think because the crow sat there, that's why the fruit fell down. The other Brahmin said, no, because the fruit is falling down, it is obstructing the path of the crow to sit down. So then they are like arguing, like who will be winning, and then they fight, and then they end up, you know, then without any conclusion. So similarly, all the Mayavadi, they will never conclude anything, even though you give many different varieties of informations to them, thousands of thousands,
yeah.
Unless Krishna within their heart really reveals them the true identity of them, then only there is a benefit.
Yeah. An important thing is to be very clear yourself so you don't get bewildered. In other words, like if you read Prabhupada's book sufficiently and you hear, you know, with the, talk with the devotees, then if you know I'm making the right points, I'm presenting the right arguments, I'm making the right points, no matter what they do, you'll feel, you know, strong within yourself. You won't be disturbed by the fact that you're not able to convince them or anything they might say. It'll just like be water off a duck's back, because you know, no, I got the right stuff here. And so even if you're not successful in getting them to come around you, so that's good. You won't be adversely affected. Prima Sankatha. Yeah, I was just thinking of that. Well, Prabhupada tells that there's a famous story of the two scholars that were arguing. And I don't know what they were exactly arguing about. Maybe it was somebody was killed or something like that, or something. Was it somebody? And the one man was saying it was with the scissors. He did it with the scissors, you know. And the other one said, no. It was the scissors. It was a scissor. And the other man said, no, it was a knife. It was a knife. And he said, no, it was scissors, you know. And they were just arguing back and forth. And one man was stronger than the other. So they happened to be near the river or something. So the stronger man threw the other man in the river. And he was, you know, said, now do you accept that it was, you know, it was knife? He says, no, it was scissors. And then he jumps in there, and he jumps in. Now do you accept that it was knife? He says, no, scissors. And finally, the man's one of them is drowning, you know. And as he's going under, he's, you know, he's going like that, holding his hand above the water. Stubborn.
So he said, if two fools are like. We know that he's fool. If you fight with them, you also become fool. So yeah. Other people doesn't know the difference if you're fighting with the fool. So that's a saying in English, the Maharaj told. We know he's talking Mayavadi philosophy, and it doesn't make any sense. We should not fight with them. You know?
Yeah, right. You waste your time.
Who is, like, property manager comes, we thought both are fools.
Yeah, our thing is we want to just engage them. We're not out there to win arguments. Nice if you can, but you know, we're trying to engage them in devotional service. And a lot of times you'll find that people who identify themselves as, say, I'm a Christian, you know, you try to give them the book, I'm a Christian, as if to say that, I can't take this, I'm a Christian. But you just kind of, rather than just kind of lock horns with them and try to, like, okay, now here he comes, I gotta, you know, defeat all their misconceptions. No, you just try to come from another angle, and you can't engage them. You know, you can engage them, and that's probably a better tactic, you know, than just trying to lock horns with them and win an argument, which you rarely do. And then even you win the argument, then you go, okay, now please take this book and give a donation. And they go, no. So what if you really just try another angle, you know? Yeah, Prabhu.
A response is also given that, you are really doing great service to society. Thank you. Something like this. Because Srila Prabhupada even said that it is not a matter of Christianity, Mormonism, and all that. If they are practicing properly in their own sect, if you will, then they are doing service. It's when they are not interpreting it properly, like in Christianity it says, thou shalt not kill, and then they go and slaughter animals. Then their own faith they are not carrying out properly.
Yeah.
But Prabhupada used to say that, if they are doing in their own religious sect things properly, leave them alone.
They are doing it, and they are doing service.
Yeah, right.
So you can sometimes compliment by them by saying, oh, well, you are doing great service to mankind. Keep it up or something.
Yeah, and then that's not tongue-in-cheek. I mean, there's that section in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, you know, fix your mind upon me without deviation. Then there's the next verse. He says, but if you can't do that, follow the regulative principles. And he says, if you can't do that, just work for me. If you can't do that, do this. And there's about three or four others, you know. So there's a hierarchy of surrender. And the idea is if somebody's not, you know, openly, like if they're not antagonistic, if they're not coming like to ruin a sale for you, or, you know, you can see they're not trying to deliberately be obnoxious, then respect their position. And, you know, like as you just said, oh, that's wonderful that you're thinking, you know, respect that, and then just try to help them, you know, come up a little bit, you know, by engaging in devotional service, yeah.
This is kind of funny and silly question, but what is the best definition of this Mayavadis? Who are they? I mean, I know this is not the topic, but...
Well, I'll give one little statement. I'm not authority, but we were just reading from the Transcendental Diary, Hari Sari, and Prabhupada was talking about that. He was invited to go to this Gita Pratishthan in, forget which part of India it was, and he was making the point that, you know, they wanted him to speak, but there was going to be a lot of other speakers there as well, and Papa was pointing out these people are all nirvishesha sunyavadi, and he explained sunyavadi are like the Buddhists, it's all zero, you know, it's all nothing, and then he said the nirvisheshvadis actually they're more dangerous, because the sunyavadis at least they come out and they say there's no God, there's nothing, you know, it's all illusion like that, but the nirvisheshvadis, he said what they are is they're people who are taking shelter of the Shankara understanding of the Vedic literatures, but you know, in doing that, they're presenting an impersonal understanding of the absolute truth, and it's offensive, you know, because they're saying that the absolute truth is without hands, without legs, without ears, eyes, nose. It's not a person. See, so they're like a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know. But basically, they're atheists, but they're coming in the guise of theists in the sense that, you know, and Prabhupada said modern day Hinduism. He said the modern day Hindus of followers of the Shankarites, you know, Shankar.
We're talking about Shankaracharya?
Yeah, that's what Papa was saying.
Now, Shankaracharya I was just reading something in the internet, actually.
Right.
He was following the Gauda Sampradaya, which is something we follow too, right?
The Gauda Sampradaya?
No. Okay. Because he was in the...
We're Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya.
Okay.
And, you know, Prabhupada, like Jesus Christ, for instance, Prabhupada didn't criticize Shankaracharya directly. He criticized his followers, who were nonsense, mostly. Because Shankaracharya said, was that verse? Bhajagovinda, mudamate, you know. Can't remember. He said, you know, you're all fools, you know. Don't be so much into this jugglery of grammatical prefixes and stuff, because it's just Bhajagovinda, you know, worship Govinda. But they didn't follow his instruction. You see, if the followers of Shankaracharya didn't follow him, unfortunately. You know, because he wrote Gita Mahatmya. In the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita, there's, I think, 8 shlokas. Those are by Shankaracharya. He was, a covered devotee of Krishna. He actually had appreciation for Krishna. But his followers didn't, you know, they're misrepresenting Shankaracharya, just like the modern-day followers of Jesus Christ are misrepresenting Jesus Christ. Prabhupada would also say, Prabhupada, did you ever hear Prabhupada criticizing Jesus Christ? There's nothing like that. I mean, the only thing he says is not criticism. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's that statement where he says how here Vasudev Dad is, here we find the personality who is millions of times greater than even Lord Jesus Christ, because he was prepared to take the sinful reaction for everybody, for all the conditioned souls in the universe, not just his followers. So, but that's not trying to criticize Jesus Christ. He was just trying to glorify Vasudev Dad. But no, Prabhupada always, you know, referred to him as Lord Jesus Christ like that. But he did criticize the followers, and he says it's difficult. It's difficult to find even one real Christian in this day and age. So, yeah, that's the thing. They're not following him properly. But in answer to your original question, that's the Nirvisheshvadis. That's the Mayavadis. They're the people who are following the Shankarite understanding of the Vedic literatures, which is that God is the absolute is impersonal, which is just a covered form of atheism. That's my understanding, anyway. You want to add something to that, or?
I think a good place to read about it is in the Adi Lila in the chapter 7, where Lord Chaitanya is talking to the sannyasis at Prakashananda Saraswati and the sannyasis in Benares. And actually he converts them all into devotees. And he explains it. And in the purports there, Srila Prabhupada explains a lot of the details and the difference. And also he explains, and I don't even remember the name, but it wasn't so much Shankaracharya himself. Although Lord Chaitanya talks about certain parts of Sharirika Pashya commentary of Vedanta Sutra of Shankaracharya, which actually, in order to push this approach to the philosophy, he actually has to, at one key part of the Vedanta Sutra, he has to say that it's actually a mistake, because in order to establish that the world is just an illusion, vivartavad, rather than a transformation of the energy of the absolute truth. But in the purport there's the name of a person, I forget the name, but the name of one of the followers of Shankaracharya who wrote some important famous books still a very long time ago, and that he was the real his is the real Mayavadi, he's the real author of the Mayavadi tradition, and everybody follows that. But so that's a good place to, if you want to understand what is Mayavadi philosophy, you can read that chapter. Read it very closely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good to read that.
Adi Lila chapter 7 is a good thing to read.
Yeah.
But I was going to say earlier that I have a technique that works well for me, and I think that I want to share with other book distributors, is I get these pamphlets from different people. Some of them are made by PETA. I don't even remember what it stands for. PETA. It's about being kind to animals and people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Yeah.
And there's another group called ChristianVeg.org, and there's a guy I meet down in Santa Cruz, and he gives me as many of these pamphlets as I want. His name is Star, and he comes by and he says, "You need some more?" And he gives me these pamphlets from ChristianVeg.org that says, "Are we good stewards of God's creation?" And they talk about all these places from the Bible and from Christianity about vegetarianism. So I have these pamphlets with me, and every once in a while, maybe once or twice, if I go out for a full day, I might meet one or two people who, say, "Well, I'm a Christian, I'm against what you're doing." And instead of talking to them and arguing with them and wasting time, I tell them, I admire that you're Christian and that you have faith in God, and that's something the world really needs. And I say, "Here, we have something, we have a Christian book." And I actually give them one of these little pamphlets, and they can immediately see that it really is a Christian book, they immediately appreciate it, and they go and they take it, sometimes they're, and I say, "If you're interested in our books," a lot of times they're not interested in our books because they think, our tradition requires us not to read books by people about Krishna or something like that. But then it diffuses the whole situation, they're happy, and sometimes they give donations and they take the book about vegetarianism and Christianity.
Yeah, that's really smart. I'd like to get some of those. It's good material. On the Warped Tour, people were there from PETA, and they were handing out their brochures as people were leaving, And it's good stuff. I mean, it's well done. It was well written, and, it was very powerful, But
yeah, I have some from PETA. I don't know where I got them from, but I noticed that I had them last time I was out. And they're similar. It's about Christianity. It's a PETA book about Christianity and vegetarianism and how... And, answers to, because a lot of Christians have considered vegetarianism, and some of them have arguments, like there was a dream that St. Paul had, and, it was really about whether Jews who had kosher dietary laws had to, not eat with Gentiles who didn't and stuff like that. And he had a dream that said he could, didn't have to worry about, there's a new covenant, and he didn't have to worry about whether the animals were clean or unclean or kosher animals. Because like Jews can't eat animals with cloven hooves like deer and certainly pork and different things. So these books, they handle all those kind of arguments, by Christians. And there's actually a movement right now in the United States, and even a lot of the conservative radio talk show hosts, Rush Limbaugh and these guys have been talking about it and pushing it. There's a movement for vegetarianism among Christians. and it's good for the environment, and it's ethically good, and all these other things. And it's, you know, it used to be that some Christians were all prepared. No, no, you know, we're not supposed to be vegetarian, but you know, at least when they hear it from their own people from the inside, it's easier to convince them.
Yeah, and that's a really good sign, because Prabhupada did say that, you know, you can't be a mediator and understand God. You know, Prabhupada never really compromised on that point. If you're a mediator, you can't understand God.
There's a verse in the beginning of the 10th canto where it's Pashuknat, right? Vinana Pashuknat. Who wouldn't? Parikshit Maharaj says, you know, this is so wonderful what you're telling me, Shukadev Goswami. Who wouldn't? You know, love to hear, you know, from a self-realized soul of all about God, except for someone who is killing himself or a butcher. Yeah,
yeah.
Atmaha is in the Isha Upanishad, but this one is Pashuknat. And Pashu means a beast, so it could be someone who kills an animal, but it also refers to one's own self. So it could be one who is a Mayavadi and therefore wants to extinguish one's ego. Mm.
So anyway, it's 10 o'clock, and we're supposed to stop now. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all the devotees, Akuranath, all the devotees, you know, for their hospitality and their wonderful association. And I'm doing this on behalf of myself and the other members of our party, genuinely enlivening and encouraging to see how Krishna consciousness being practiced so sincerely and enthusiastically here in San Jose. And also, I'd just like to mention, yesterday we were in Berkeley, and I was really pleasantly surprised by what I saw. I haven't been there for 2 or 3 years. When I went in the temple, it was really neat and clean and organized, nice atmosphere. The morning program was really together. There's like a core of devotees there that seem to be very, you know, seriously and sincerely trying to follow Prabhupada's program and, you know, engage in devotional service. And that was enlivening, because that temple has been like a, you know, a problem for years and years and years. But I just felt like, whoa, this is nice. So things are looking up. So anyway, thank you very much, Jai. Grantarat Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Prabhu Ki Jai.